blew me off for a bottle of tequila. Tequila's no good for you. Doesn't call, doesn't write. It's not nearly as much fun to wake up to.
Did you know what the name of the game song was? Did you have any idea?
No.
I had to look this one up as well because I'd never heard it. And there's a fair reason that I'd never heard it because I've got a feeling you're going to disagree with me here. This is one of my least favorite bands of all time. Tell me if you can figure out who it is.
Is it ABBA?
It's ABBA.
Oh.
Unknown ABBA track I've never heard before.
Oh, that's so interesting.
The second you hear it, though, you absolutely clock it as ABBA.
Ooh. Because, I mean, ABBA has such a distinct sound. That makes sense.
Yeah, like cats in a barrel.
You don't like ABBA?
Oh, Fire of a Thousand Suns. I hate ABBA.
I like ABBA.
No, thank you.
Give me A Man After Midnight. It's a banger.
Give me a clue and a better start to our podcast. Hi, everyone. I'm Ayla.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tamsin, and welcome to Scalpels and Tequila.
If you hadn't guessed already, today we are talking season 2, episode 21. We're nearly at the end of season 2. The name of the game.
Actually, it's episode 22.
Balls.
Yeah, and do you know what? We were wrong last episode. We thought there was only 3 episodes left. There's actually, it goes up to 27 this season.
What? Is this the longest season?
I don't know. I know we looked up that like ages ago, like when we were doing season 1. But yes, there's 27 episodes this season.
I hate that.
So no wonder we thought so much was going to happen and how it was going to happen in 3 episodes. It's not. It's going to happen in 5 episodes.
I know, but it means it's actually going to happen the way we think it's going to happen. And I am not prepared.
Nope.
You've been looking ahead, Tamsin.
I was confused about the timeline.
Cheetah.
Oh, yeah, I shouldn't have.
Pumpkin eater. She's a vegan.
Love pumpkin.
I went grocery shopping this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And for all of our American listeners out there, there is currently a fruit and vegetable crisis happening in Melbourne. And I went to buy a pumpkin. And they wanted to charge me $13 for a pumpkin.
A whole? Do you buy whole pumpkins, though?
I was going to buy a whole pumpkin.
Why?
Not a blue pumpkin, a butternut squash.
Oh, $13 for a pumpkin.
No, the cauliflower was worse, though, because normally the cauliflower is like $3. So I get the smallest one because it's just Evan and I, and we don't need a giant cauliflower. So I found a tiny cauliflower and I was exceedingly happy with it until I found out it was $8 at the market.
Oh, it's a scary world.
How are you existing as someone who only eats vegetables? Because the meat's the same price.
I haven't come up with anything too expensive yet. I've just been buying lots of broccoli. That's kind of the same.
I live on a diet of broccoli and tears.
But welcome to season 2, episode 22, The Name of the Game. So it's pretty obvious and clear what this episode is all about. It is all about games, which is, you know, in the theme of Grey's Anatomy in general, because we do come into the Grey's Anatomy world with the pilot episode and they are explaining that surgery is a game. This is the playing field.
And they're all competing constantly. Mm-hmm.
So we are back here at this game metaphor. And everyone is playing games this episode, whether they're physical games or emotional games or relationship games. And Meredith's monologue, she says, games are all about the glory, pain, and the play-by-play. And then there are the more solitary games, the games we play by ourselves, the social games, the mind games. We use them to pass the time to make life more interesting, to distract us from what's really going on. What do you think of games?
I'm terrible at sports ball.
What about board? I love a board game.
Oh, I love cards.
Mm.
I play lots of cards. I get quite shocked when people say they don't play cards. I'm a real sucker for games like Tetris. And Bejeweled.
So solitary games.
Oh, solitaire actually is a game that I spent most of the flight home from Thailand playing solitaire on the back of my chair.
Fair.
You're a big board game fan though, aren't you?
Huge board game person. I love a games night. I'm always there for a games night.
Monopoly.
Love Monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to play Monopoly.
Do you get too violent?
No, Evan thinks I cheat.
Okay.
I have a savings account.
Yeah, that's fair.
He thinks it's not.
Well,
he's like, but you hide money. And I'm like, yes, from myself.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Okay, I think that's fine. Thank you. I'm going to need you to message Evan later and tell him that.
Little things that make games more fun. So when we play Monopoly, me and Tom came into our relationship and our board game-ness with different ideas about how you play Monopoly. So I'm one of those people that believe in if I land on one of his spaces and if he doesn't notice, then I don't have to pay. I'm just squatting.
That's an actual rule in Monopoly.
He believes that I'm always cheating because I don't tell him when I land on it. And I'm like, but that's part of the fun.
That's also part of the rules. We got Monopoly and read the rules. You know that whole the community chest and stuff. It's like pay $200 and everyone puts it in the middle. And if you want a free parking, you get it.
Yeah,
that is not a rule of Monopoly.
It's like pool though. Like it's house rules. I feel exactly. Monopoly. Yeah.
But if you read the rules on the box, it said a game of Monopoly should take 45 minutes to an hour. It's all the crap that we had that makes it last 3 days and ruins families.
Totally agreed.
The games I can't abide though, apart from the sports balls, are definitely the games I watch people play in relationships. And there is a lot of that going on this episode.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, relationship games are weirdly what you're taught as a kid, I feel, especially as a woman. I feel like when you're younger, you're taught like the boy pulls your hair, he likes you. If he ignores you, he likes you.
That's exactly what I was about to bring up.
It's so true. It's like we're taught to play games and we have to unlearn so much to end up in healthy relationships.
Oh, the amount of friends who are just like, no, I can't message them back because, you know, it's only been so long. And I'm like, why? Oh, because I'll seem too eager. And I'm like, but you are eager.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Took me a long, long time to unlearn all that. I was definitely that person. No. Or stressing if you send too many messages in a row by accident or not by accident because you're excited and how bad that is. And there's so much of that.
Nothing better than being a woman and those unrealistic expectations. And I feel like Bailey's really copping a lot of that this episode. Exactly what you said would happen is happening.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. So
getting into this episode, this is an episode that I could not watch again. It's actually one that I didn't remember
having seen before. That's interesting listening to you say that because I like this episode.
Why do you like this episode?
I think everything we learn, I think this is a really important episode for a lot of the characters. I think there's so much character development and we learn so much, especially Meredith.
Mm.
I think it's an important episode. And I do think some scenes are really, really good. I really love watching Bailey talking to the spelling bee kid in the operating room. I think that's a really beautiful scene. And the mother and daughter at the end, even though, yes, some of the things that she's saying are a little antiquated now, but I think that scene is really beautiful.
I will say I couldn't take notes during George's monologue describing Meredith. I thought that was a really nice insight, but I just think overall this episode's a bit
cool. Well, it's interesting. That's going to make our discussions interesting, I think. So let's get into it.
Mm-hmm.
We open on Meredith and she is knitting. She's knitting in the bar, which is interesting, but, it's cute.
She looks so uncomfortable.
Well, she just looks awkward and bad at it, but that's part of the whole storyline. So she's knitting and we learn that she's sworn off boys and that she's celibate. And everyone knows what happens as soon as you swear off dating. And then we see this friendship play out with her, Derek, and Addison, where they're like, oh, we're all friends now. We're all chummy. What are you doing knitting? And they kind of have a little back and forth and banter, the three of them.
I end up dating married men, sorry, or the wrong men, sorry.
Yeah, and she mentions Mark, which is interesting.
Which is weird.
Super weird. I think it's super weird. Purely written in there for her to connect with Addison.
I don't think Addison needed another reason to dislike her. Yeah, it was odd. I don't know how I felt about, well, do you want a drink? It's like, no, I can't. I'm celibate. Oh, but you mean, oh, what's it called when people don't drink?
Sober.
Sober. Mm. No, I can't have a drink because I'm celibate. If I drink, bad things happen. I'm like, what? That's a red flag there, Meh.
That's so true. That's so true. I didn't think about it like that, but I guess like she just shouldn't be at the bar. That's the thing. This whole storyline, the whole thing about her meeting Derek at the bar when they were drinking, that's kind of why she's saying that. It's like, I can't drink here. I can't drink because I'll sleep with someone, because she slept with George and she slept with Derek, and you can have a drink and not sleep with someone.
I'm so sorry. I've been trying to watch scary movies and your blanket just started moving and I completely forgot that the cat was under there.
Yeah, behind me on the couch there is a lump under a blanket, which is my cat. And, yeah, he'll probably wriggle a little bit more.
Yeah, so I apologize for those noises.
No
one
cute.
Needed to hear that.
We also open on Burke and Christina's apartment, and Callie and George are there, and the four of them are playing a game.
Who goes on their first date to a friend's house? That's a lot.
It is, isn't it? Except that they all know each other. Like, I'm assuming Burke and Callie are friends because they're both attendings.
Is she an attending or is she a resident?
Like maybe Bailey. She's just a resident at this point, actually. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's weird.
It's super weird.
It's super weird. And Christina is super uncomfortable because not only is George still at her apartment, which she's not super keen on, but Callie is there as well. He's brought a girl over.
They're having such a good time.
More
importantly, they're winning. And that's probably the biggest problem.
Yeah, Christina's hating it.
Absolutely hating life.
And it just, again, proves how terrible Burke and Christina are at communicating. Because this is some sort of game. It's like Celebrity Heads, but it's like guess who I am without saying the word, I guess.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know what this game's called, but all right.
I don't know what
I'm
this game is either.
I'm thinking of a person.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very tall. They host a game show and they will not touch or go anywhere near any of their competitors, any of the people that are competing. They also have terrible catchphrases and like to wear fancy suits.
RuPaul's Drag Race. Oh, RuPaul.
There we go.
Good.
Figured it out.
Yeah, so I guess that's the game. And Burke doesn't know who Madonna is, which is wild.
Yeah, the second Christina said Vogue, I was like, done.
The second she said Blonde Ambition to her.
Yes, that also.
But also it goes back to this communication thing because Christina says Blonde Ambition to her. He clearly isn't getting it. And so she just continues to say Blonde Ambition to her. She's blonde. She has ambition. She had a tour. And then she's like, and Vogue, Vogue. And they
she
just
throws
clearly
in a cone bra.
Oh, does she? Yeah.
I love that Madonna's gone full circle and doesn't wear bras anymore.
Madonna can do whatever she wants.
Did you see the pictures from Britney Spears' wedding?
Yes.
And it was like Donatella Versace, Paris Hilton, Britney, Madonna looking like Donatella Versace. Those glasses, they killed me. Amazing. I want to wear a muumuu and be fashionable.
The other opening we get is Izzy and Denny. Now, this is really sweet. We have Izzy knitting, kind of sitting on Denny's bed and
playing Scrabble.
She's telling him all about all of her friends.
I think she's bitching about all of her friends.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that because I just think it's really, he's listening and he knows who she's talking about. And he's asking little questions and he's getting involved in her life. And I just really like that because I just don't think Alex was doing that.
Yeah, but neither does Burke and neither does Derek.
Totally.
None of our boys do that.
No. They date the girls solely in a bubble.
Yep.
That only exist when it's just the two of them. Behind closed doors. They don't date these girls out in the open. They don't date them and get to know their entire world. They date them in like a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Denny really getting involved in all of these stories and all of these details that Izzy's explaining. Even the way that she's like, I'm knitting this for Meredith because Meredith's knitting. We both took a vow of celibacy and Meredith can't knit. So I'm going to help her and make her feel like
and
she's
swap
knitting.
Swap them out every day. Oh, I thought that was the cutest thing.
The cutest thing.
The cutest. And do we think that Izzy has taken back the kiss?
It's odd that we don't hear about it.
Well, he says that his doctor promised sexual favors and she's like, I absolutely did not. I'm your doctor. You can't talk to me that way. So she's not going to get off his service then.
No, she's going to stay his doctor.
Sounds like a great idea, Izzy. I hope that pans out for you.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
It's bad.
It's so not okay. But the way that they joke about sex is really cute. All of this flirting is adorable. They really do have amazing chemistry.
He is simultaneously dirty and sexy.
Yeah.
And sweet. It's very strange because you're like, if anyone else said that to me, I'd be a bit like, oh, naughty. But from Denny, you're like, okay.
I don't think it's even dirt. It's like more cheeky.
Yeah.
Mm.
But is it just Denny that gets away with it?
Yeah. If Alex was, oh, no. I don't know. It's the way that he does it in like such a innocent, non-threatening way. He's also so sick in a bed. Maybe that's because he can't do anything about it.
I think it's because he's so sensitive. Like you said, he's asking all the questions, but then also just like sprinkling some filth in there. Just one boob.
It's cute. The one boob. It's funny. Yeah. He's trying to make her laugh.
Mm-hmm. And he's doing exactly. Oh, the game, the primary school game, the boy game of like treat him mean, keep him keen. Because she says, you know, you're not getting any sexual favors from me. And he's like, oh, that's all right. I thought about it in my mind and you were terrible anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What's that called? When men do the thing where they're like,
negging. Go,
yeah, negging.
But I think he's doing it he's doing it in a cheeky, playful way. It's not like he's constantly being like, you're awful, you're the worst.
I know, but constantly. It plays into the theme of the episode.
True.
The game that men play where they're like, oh, I bet you can't do this or you wouldn't do that. So we go out of our way to prove that we can.
Mm. But she's kind of doing it too because she's like, I'm celibate. Nothing can happen with us. Ha, ha, ha.
Ha. So bye.
The other little moment we get, and I'm going to say it's part of the setup, is this really cute scene with Christina, Izzy, and Meredith. Because I love any time that it's just the three girls having a chat. And they're up in the gallery, and we've got Izzy and Meredith both knitting. And Christina is just losing her mind and explaining how annoyed she is that she lost this game and how Burke didn't know Madonna, and that to be the best surgeon, you have to be the best at everything, including games. And the girls just knit and let her rave and rant. She is such a poor loser.
Such a poor loser. But the surgery they're overlooking is Dr. Burke and Alex. Have we seen Dr. Burke and Alex work together like this before?
I don't.
For a long time.
They definitely don't work together much, because Burke either kind of works with Christina or George most of the time.
Yeah. So it's nice to see them working together today. And they're working with, I couldn't catch her name, but Mrs. Carver. She's played by Laurie Metcalf, who I love.
Yeah, who's a legend in her own right.
I have a very fun fact about Laurie Metcalf.
Bring it on.
Do you know who she was married to that is also a character this week?
No.
Her and Jeff Perry, Thatcher, were married.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they were married. They were divorced by the time this was filmed and aired. Fun fact number dos.
Yeah.
They have a daughter. Her name is Zoe. And she was in an episode of Grey's Anatomy in season 9 being treated by Christina. Play Family Affair by Mary J.
The daughter was?
Yeah. Their real-life daughter.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Thought you'd enjoy that.
That's cool. I love knowing that. That's such a good fact.
Hey, I came through with the research. You're welcome.
Yeah, so good.
This is supposed to be your part of the podcast.
True.
So on set, no one really realised the sort of boo-boo that they'd done filming this. So they had to film them on set on different days separately, because they were like...
Oh, they don't like... they don't get along.
No. That's why they're not in any scenes together.
And they also don't need to be in any scenes together.
No, they don't need to be any scenes, but the gossip's worth it.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
So Laurie Metcalf's character has metastasized lung cancer. And this pissed me off. When Dr. Burke and Alex are operating, Alex says something along the lines of, you know, she's a goner. And Burke pulls him up in his shitty bedside manner. And I'm just sitting here like, you do understand who you're dating, right?
But I think Burke would pull Christina up on her bedside manner. But I don't think Christina's immune.
No, but we literally watched him, the last time we worked with Alex actually, kick Alex off for poor bedside manner and then keep Christina on even though she did the exact same thing.
True. Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really annoying.
So do you want to kind of talk about her?
Yeah, definitely. So her storyline is really closely linked to Alex today. So Laurie Metcalf's character, who...
Beatrice Carver.
So
she should be a children's story writer.
So Beatrice hasn't actually explained to her daughter what's wrong with her. And she knows that she's very, very sick. And
no, she doesn't know she's very sick. She just knows that her mum's kind of unwell and is in hospital. She knows
Beatrice
nothing.
Knows that she's herself is very, very sick. And she does find out from Burke and Alex that
it's the end of the line.
It's the end. This is kind of her last, they don't give her an exact time frame, but it seems like it's her last days, weeks.
There's no more that they can do.
Yeah. And if she leaves the hospital, Alex makes this comment saying that if you leave and your daughter doesn't know what's wrong with you, you could just drop dead in the middle of the street. So that kind of gives the indication that she's really, really in her last moments.
Well, because it's her daughter's birthday tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so she's fighting with Burke and Alex. Initially, she's just yelling at them to go back in and take everything out that they can, give her more time. And the next time we see her, she's trying to pull out her oxygen and trying to get up, and they're having to restrain her because she wants to leave the hospital. And Alex kind of rightly says, like, you can, but you could die on the street if you don't give your body a chance to rest.
So her daughter is being a bit of a typical teenager. She's kind of moping around. She doesn't really know why they're there. So she's, you know, clearly getting a bit agitated. She wants to go home. The food isn't good. She's just complaining, which I also kind of, you know, I understand. We've been teenagers. She doesn't want to be there. And Alex says, you have to tell her what's wrong with you. You have to say that you're dying, like you have to tell your daughter. And Bert kind of thinks that Alex is overstepping.
Well, he does say something really rough. He says to her, so this whole lying thing, how's it working out for you? She goes on to explain that, you know, you'll never know the true love of a kid until you have one, blah, 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 who cares? And he's just super straight up with her and says, you should know you're leaving behind a kid that will hate you for the rest of their life if you do this.
Which is a huge thing to say, Alex. It's not a good thing to say. And also he doesn't know, but I guess what we kind of learn from that is we know that something's up with Alex's family. We know that Alex has had a bit of a troubled childhood, but we don't fully know the ins and outs of it.
We also know that this tactic has worked in the past for Alex, giving people the harsh truth, not sugarcoating it or anything like that, has mm-hmm. helped them to make these decisions. Like
you just spoke to Denny last week.
Yep, and the kid who had an abusive father and there was lying going on.
Mm-hmm.
But Burke sees all of this just as he's saying this kid's going to hate you for the rest of their life. And does a very quick, out you pop, come outside and have a chat with me.
And this is where we get Alex kind of pleading his case. He says, I tell the truth. It's what I do. It doesn't make me a bad doctor. Everyone walks around here lying. Maybe I'm a pig. Maybe I'm an ass. Maybe I'm vermin like everyone thinks I am, but I tell the truth. It's the one thing I've got going for me. Don't take that away from me.
I would absolutely say he's not pleading his case. I think he's just laying it straight and is setting a boundary.
Look, I don't think Alex is going about this the right way, but I think he's doing the right thing at the end of the day.
I agree. And Burke doesn't really have a response for it because it is their job as surgeons and as doctors to tell their patients the truth. And if I was in that kind of a situation, I would 100% want to know the truth of what's going on.
Yeah, but I guess like the thing that Alex is doing is it's not like he's not telling his patient the truth. He's telling his patient to tell her daughter the truth.
I don't think she really conceptualizes what's sort of about to happen.
Right.
With it all. But this gets through to her. And the way that she decides to go about telling her daughter how unwell she is by giving her a list of life tips.
Oh, actually, before we get into the life tips, I just want to say, because I just thought about it then, I think maybe the reason this is so hard for Burke to digest and understand, and probably the reason why he doesn't actually say anything back to Alex at this moment, is because Burke has no idea how to talk about his feelings. He has no idea how to tell the truth about what's going on for him. He's a terrible communicator.
he also spends most of his time calculating his words and figuring out the best thing to say to get the outcome that he wants.
Yeah, I don't think he doesn't communicate his feelings. He doesn't listen to his heart in that way. It definitely gets over-processed in his brain, and then we only hear bits and pieces about what he's really thinking and what he's really feeling. So I think hearing Alex say this is just probably something he's never quite understood how to do. Okay, the list, the motherly advice.
The list of, you know, the most important things that a young woman, God, I hated being called a young woman when I was that age.
I'm not yet a woman. All I need is time. The moment that is mine.
All I picture is the part of the video clip where she's like in the clouds.
Yeah. Or standing on a hill or something.
I wonder how many more Britney references we're going to get in this episode.
I hope a lot.
So many. All right. Game plan set. So one, useful. She's going to have to pick some higher subjects if she wants to go to university.
Yeah, take two AP classes. You'll need them mm-hmm. to get into college.
Second one, if you're wearing stockings, you should wear underwear underneath them. I know it feels bulky, but it's frankly a little slutty not to wear anything under pantyhose. I'm currently sitting here in pantyhose with nothing underneath.
But that's how you get a yeast infection, Ayla.
I've never had a yeast infection.
You've never had a yeast infection?
Mm-mm.
Ever?
Mm-mm.
I think you deserve an award. I think if the mum just cut out the slutty bit and just said, wear underwear with pantyhose because that's how you get a yeast infection. Like, I think that would be enough. Even though Ayla
has a magical vagina, yes.
Has a magical vagina. Not everyone does. And I think that would have been, that's a cute piece of advice without the slut comment.
Correct. I think the advice on the next one was quite good. And that was find yourself a good man. And if he still lives at home with his mum, run the other way.
Really good.
Mm-hmm.
Really good.
Unless you've got a reason. I have a friend who lives with their mother. For valid reasons. They were saving up for a house and we're millennials, so Tamsin is one of the few that's been able to afford to buy a house. And he's one of seven children and everyone's moved out. And then his father passed away and he was worried about his mum being lonely. So
yeah, that's a really valid reason.
To stay. So props to you, Maury. Good job, buddy. That's the valid reason. Go marry my mate Maury. He's a really stand-up guy. But on your wedding day, make sure that you only have one glass of sparkling wine.
Of champagne, and then drink water for the rest of the night.
Because there's nothing tackier than a drunken bride.
So
that's why we do cocaine.
I don't mind this, but I'm just going to change the way. I feel like what we're doing is we're updating the mum advice. So I think it should be something like be aware of your alcohol consumption on your wedding day because you want to be able to remember it.
It's exactly where I thought she was going with it.
Yeah.
And then when the tackiness came out, I was like, no.
Nah, be drunk. Have a great time. Dance. Have a
great time.
Pull your pantyhose off. Flash your vajayjay. Have the best time ever. But just make sure you remember it. I think that's the important bit.
Part of me, at my shindig, I remember people like grabbing me and wanting to talk to me because, you know, my day, whatever. And I still feel really rude for all the people that I said, I'm so sorry. I'd love to continue this conversation, but this is my song. And I ran onto the dance floor. But like, I did what made me happy.
Yeah.
On what was supposed to be the happiest day of my life. I barely saw Evan, so it was great.
Just dance.
Some bitch kissed me right on the cheek with red lipstick two seconds into the wedding.
I'm so sorry.
I'm going to wear the reddest lipstick at your wedding. Just bear warning.
Oh my God. I feel so bad about that.
But I will get my revenge.
It should have brought some concealer foundation or something. I don't know.
It was the worst. Bright red lipstick.
I know.
So not terrible motherly advice, but she definitely needed some updating and was frankly a little judgy.
No, the last one can stay the same, except for one little part of it.
Okay.
She says, when you have a kid, that's the only bit I want to change. It should be, if you have a kid.
If you have a kid.
And then she goes on to say something along the lines of, it doesn't matter if they do art or sport or science. The only thing that matters is that your kid is happy.
Oh, love that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then she says, so don't be sad forever. Speaking, which she's kind of implying, like, once I die, you will be, she says, like, you will be sad, but don't be sad forever.
Yeah. Oh, I just remembered she's pretty judgy on her sister not getting her eyebrows done frequently enough.
Oh, yeah, I just skipped over that bit.
I was like, I'm routinely bad at getting my eyebrows done.
The other thing I thought was interesting about that was that she says, your Aunt Sue isn't personal good with hygiene? Personal hygiene.
And apparently so
I thought she was. I thought it was going to be like, you need to remind her that, you know, to buy soap
and to
brush your teeth. But no, it was like, get your eyebrows waxed.
And your hair cut.
It's like, that's not personal hygiene.
No. Getting your eyebrows waxed has nothing to do with your hygiene.
No, neither does getting a haircut.
Everything to do with your pain tolerance. Wah.
But anyway, look, she ends on a really good one.
Yeah, she does.
And this moment is still really sad because you're watching this daughter slowly realize during this, like, mum's advice that her mum's going to die. And it's pretty heartbreaking.
And she gives her mum a hug and her mother just aggressively snorts at the top of her head.
It's sad.
Okay. Do you... Well, because she mentions the whole, like, you hold your baby for the first time and you sniff the top of its head. Oh,
I've never sniffed a baby, so I don't know. People talk about that all the time.
Oh, you
know, I have no plans on sniffing a baby.
I smelt it once. My niece. It smells like hot milk and cantaloupe.
Ew.
Yeah, it's not. Listeners out there, what do you think that baby heads smell like? Are you into it? Are you currently riddled with goosebumps like you just heard nails on a chalkboard like Tamsin and I? Let us know. Reach out. Love to hear your thoughts.
So, next storyline for this episode, I kind of want to have a little chat about what happens with Christina.
I think that's the one you were going to go with.
So after Christina loses her game of whatever that game was.
I keep wanting to say charades, but
she basically needs a fix. Yes, she needs a winning fix. She's feeling like she's a terrible surgeon because she can't win. Guess who? So she jumps into the skills lab to learn a new skill, and who comes and sits with her? Well, not with her, but in the same room is Chief Webber. And this is just cute little comic relief, little storyline. And basically Christina and Webber are basically battling it out in the skills lab all day. Christina starts and she's the first one to finish and she gets really excited. She's like, I'm done. I'm finished. I'm better than you. And then later.
Because they're doing laparoscopic skills labs. So she's learning how to pick things up and put it in little holes. Mm-hmm. And Webber's fumbling with his big grandpa fingers.
Yeah, so she is winning. She's kicking the Chief's ass and she loves it. She loves every second of it.
And she's then, being a bit of a toxic winner.
Yeah, I mean, she's very competitive.
That was a Britney Spears reference.
Oh, I didn't get that.
That's fine. You can cut that one out.
No, I'm not cutting anything out.
Rude.
No, I was thinking about other Brit. I was like, she basically turns to the chief and she says, "You better work, bitch."
Damn it, I ruined it. I'm so sorry.
Later in the day, Richard beats her at something and she and is actually really funny. He says, like, "That's why I'm the chief." And then he's like, "That's why they I'm
call me
the chief.
Dr. Webber."
"That's why I'm the chief.
But he says chief right in her face. There must have been spittle involved. But there, it's a not necessarily a competition, but basically the last practical of this is that they've all got to do sutures with the laparoscopic machine. And I've just remembered at the very start of this, the doctor says, "In the next 5 to 10 years, we won't even use scalpels anymore."
Mm.
He's wrong. And she notices that Dr. Webber is doing the whole thing with his eyes closed. He's not
and
even
beats
looking
her.
At the camera and beats her.
And she's perfect. Absolutely blown away, mm-hmm. completely blown out of the water to the point where she follows him out at the end of the day and asks him. She's like, "You didn't even need the screen to help you guide the needle holder." She's so impressed and so shocked. And Webber says, "Old school gang, muscle memory. You want to win? Always go back to the basics." Like a boss. It's like a mic drop moment and he walks off into the darkness. Like the end of a Western.
It's got nothing to do with him being so lucky. He's just a star.
Ooh. Good. Good.
Very good. And she takes that to heart.
Mm-hmm. In a very different way because she gets a little light bulb. This is one of my favorite moments of this whole episode.
I think one of my favorite moments is the lunch break.
Mm.
Everyone sort of gathers in the canteen and George is the king of secrets today. He gives everyone some information, so to get it off his chest. We'll talk about it in a minute. And Christina's dishing on the chief and is like, "I beat him. I'm the best." And then the chief comes up mm-hmm. and tries to sit down and like have lunch with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite sweet until he notices that he is making everyone deeply uncomfortable.
Bonding. He's trying to do bonding.
He's trying to do the bonding.
That's
God,
failing.
I don't even know what slang was popular then. Maybe he should have said, "What's up?" and hoped for the best.
That would be so awkward.
Yes.
It's a cute scene. I really like it when Webber's uncomfortable. He's trying to hang with the kids. It doesn't work. He instantly realizes that he is out of his element. And he leaves.
Mm-hmm.
But this is when he talks about the basics as well. So this is right before he kind of whips
Christina.
And he says the basics are key. You need a solid foundation before anything else. And that's.
And I think we learn this episode that Christina has a phenomenal foundation.
So she takes the idea of going back to basics to heart because she wants to win. And something that's been plaguing her for the last few episodes is that she really wants George out. She let him stay for one more night last week because he was having a bit of a rough day, but he's fine now. So she comes home from the hospital.
Because she knows that she can't kick him out because, mm-hmm. as she says, he's Burke's puppy and I've got to figure out how to make him get rid of George.
Mm-hmm.
And Webber helps it out.
She walks through her kitchen and
Burke and George are quietly playing chess over a few beers.
And she's stark naked, calm, cool, like a cucumber, all eyes on her in the center of the ring, just like a circus.
Yes. It's crazy. I just can't speak.
And George says, I didn't see anything, dude. I did not see anything. And Bert gets so uncomfortable, he yells at George and says, out now.
I'm just, Christina. I'm just being comfortable in my apartment.
Fair enough. It's her apartment. She needs to be able to feel comfortable. And then she gets a cute little smirk on her face as she walks away and she says to herself, basics. And it is brilliant.
So good. Ah.
Really, really good storyline.
Wants to murder her or mount her?
Yeah. I don't think he knows either.
No, he's definitely been. Oh, speaking of people that have been mounted, we also meet Molly Thompson this episode.
Whoa. What a segue.
I love Molly Thompson.
So this is kind of this, I mean, this is the most important storyline of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is really important for this reason. Molly comes in. Molly is pregnant.
Addison, she has congenital diaphragmatic hernia, the baby. I think I did that right.
I don't know.
I couldn't give it.
Addison is doing a checkup on her, and with Addison is
Georgie.
George. She's 22 years old. She is 32 weeks pregnant, so she's about to pop.
Can you imagine? We would have 10-year-olds by now.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So we also meet her mum.
Who's a bit of a tiger mum.
Tiger mum, very protective.
Which makes sense because her daughter is a child still. My golly, 21, having a baby.
Yeah. But the main important thing that happens is that as George is walking away from this room, he bumps into this man who we know to be Thatcher Gray, Meredith's mum. And he flags down George and says, is Meredith here?
And he's very erratic and very uncomfortable.
He's very uncomfortable being in this hospital, being in this space, which makes sense because he spent a long time in this hospital.
Mm-hmm.
This is the place where his wife cheated on him, where his wife broke him.
As where he said. Stood around for hours at a time with a baby on his hip trying to figure out when he was going to be able to see his wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this ruined his life.
In this episode, George is the one who connects the dots. He meets Thatcher. He knows it's Meredith's dad. He knows that that's Meredith's stepsister having a baby and Meredith's stepmom. And he puts all these pieces together and realizes that Meredith has no idea that she even has a sister, let alone a pregnant sister.
You also kind of see how similar Thatcher and George are in their mannerisms. They're both kind of awkward and sort of nervous and a little bit ticky. They're very similar. Neither of them has any confidence or gusto.
Definitely. And I think that is important because that really adds to the story from way back when we meet Ellis and she comes into the hospital and she calls George Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes a lot of sense that these two have these similarities. And then where they are also similar is in we get more of this story. We get more of Meredith's backstory, and that's what's really important here. We learn this episode that Thatcher did spend a lot of time in this hospital waiting for his wife, and we know that she was cheating on him with Richard. And I don't know, should we just go right into it? Should we just talk about it or should we go break it down?
Yeah, I think so. So George has this information and he's still being really angry with Meredith, and we're seeing a lot of it this episode, and it's just appearing more and more childish. Like when
this is the game. Part of this game that is being played, where George is kind of being very juvenile in the way that he's ignoring Meredith, cut Meredith out of his life. He's so hurt by her. And Izzy, when Izzy is talking about George to Denny, she uses the word broken. Mm-hmm. She says Meredith broke him.
Changed him completely. But I think part of it's a choice as well. Like,
definitely. They're
all sitting around having lunch. Meredith comes and sits down. He just like up and leaves. Like, just finish your lunch, dude.
Yeah. It's definitely a choice. It's very dramatic. It's very juvenile.
Yeah. But this figuring out that her father's there and that she's got a sister is really plaguing George. And I think that he is struggling with the idea that he still cares about her because he wants her to know. So he finds Izzy and says, I'm going to tell you something, and then the responsibility is on you. So at lunch he tells Izzy and Christina that Meredith's got a sister and her father's in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And as George storms off at lunch and Meredith sits down, Meredith's like, look, if he wants to be that way, that's fine. There's nothing I can do. I'm going to give him a minute, which I think is pretty big of her. And she says, that's really weird. I thought I saw my father. And the girls suddenly think they're off the hook.
Yeah. Which
no more than Christina.
Yeah, who says, oh, great. Well, you met your sister then. And that's how the bomb is dropped.
That's it. And George has the opportunity today to do some medicine, and he doesn't. He's running around the hospital until he gets caught by Addison, who's furious that he hasn't gone to get a CT scan anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And George tells her everything that's happening, and she's like, okay, you can go away. So Addison goes back to see the patient, and as she's about to leave, sees Meredith standing in the doorway. And very quickly covers for her and says, this is Meredith. This is Meredith.
Mm.
She's going to come in and do your prep work. And it gives Molly and Meredith a chance to have a conversation. And it is just like Hiroshima in there. Bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb. First ones. That's a pretty ring. Oh, it's a family heirloom. It was from my grandmother, given to my mother. And now it's mine. I'm the youngest, which, you know. Oh, no, she's like, I'm the eldest. Meredith's like, no, I'm the eldest. I'm 22. My dad's, you know, he's like a dad. He's very overprotective. Bomb goes off. He cried at my wedding when he gave me away. Bomb goes off. He's so proud of me, but not as proud as he is of my sister, Lexi. Another sister. She's in medical school, so he's double proud of her. Boom, 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 boom.
So this is such an important moment for Meredith, because in her brain, Meredith has always known her dad to be this kind of deadbeat dad who left them, who walked out on them, who didn't try to create a family, who didn't want to be a dad. That's the way in her head her dad is. And then this is the first time that Meredith has ever heard that her dad could possibly have been a really good dad, like a present dad, a proud dad, a totally different version of a dad that she has in her head. And it just must be so incredibly hard, because this is completely shifting her reality.
I don't think she sees it as, oh, he could be a good guy. I think she sees it as, why was I left behind?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Like, because there's here's this woman, and my dad was
loves her.
A loving dad to this person, but he wasn't to me.
Mm-mm.
So that's a huge bombshell for Meredith. The next big thing that happens is that Meredith bumps into her stepmother in a hallway. And this is where she learns a bit more. And she says that she kind of stops Meredith and says, I know you from anywhere. You look exactly like your mother. I've seen photos.
You look just like my daughters.
You look just like my daughters.
Then she says, my daughters know about you.
She doesn't, yeah, they don't know about you, but they know that Thatcher has another daughter. And she says, your mother broke him. Your father thinks about you a lot. It must be triggering for him to be here. Actually, she doesn't say that, but that's, sorry, that's my notes. Mm. It must be very triggering for him to be here, the place where his wife cheated on him. And I think this is this stepmom trying to smooth it over a little bit and be like, he's not a terrible guy. Like, he wanted to be in your life, but your mother pushed him away.
And he actually spends this entire episode not by his daughter's side, but wandering around the hospital trying to find Meredith.
He's also very, like, lost in emotion, I think. I think a lot of his past is coming back to him. He's in this place that he spent so many hours before, and it must feel like a whole lifetime ago. And it's all coming back to him. And so the next key scene in this storyline is Thatcher is looking up at the OR board, and he's not just some random in the hospital looking at something he doesn't understand. He's reading that board, and Richard sidles up towards to him. And we learn that Thatcher knows this place so well. He starts saying, like, I used to stand in front of this board with this baby, and I know that if such and such a surgery is going on, I wasn't going to see my wife for an hour, but if it was this sort of surgery, I would be lucky if I saw her for the rest of the night. And he got to know the surgeries by how long it took to see his wife again, how long the surgeries took, which is quite sad, honestly.
Yeah.
And it shows his dedication, the fact that he spent so much time staring up, trying to figure out when he'd get to see her.
How willing he was to fight for their relationship, especially since we find out that he knew it was Weber.
Mm-hmm.
Because Weber says to him, do you know about Ellis? And Thatcher just says, you have no right to talk to me about Ellis. Because Thatcher doesn't know they didn't end up together.
No. No. He doesn't. And Richard ends up telling him that Ellis has Alzheimer's and Meredith is having a really hard time with it. And I do think it's important that Thatcher knows this. Not that Thatcher can do anything or fix anything, but I think it's important that he knows. And I can't quite understand why I think that's so important, but it's like, in some way, it like completes the picture.
So like, that he has the opportunity to be there for his daughter if he were to, you know, want to make amends for everything.
Totally.
Then this could be something that he could help with.
Mm.
He doesn't really owe Ellis much, but he does owe his daughter support. And from everything we've heard about him so far from Molly, he certainly is the kind of man that would want to help.
Yep.
And so he does spend the rest of his time at the hospital wandering around trying to find Meredith. And he does. And she runs away, hides in a boardroom.
Well, she just hides behind a wall.
Mm. And George is there and he sees this and he stops Thatcher to have a chat with him.
This is the final part of this storyline. And again, it's so important. There's so many, we get so much like meat of this story, this episode, and I think it is really important. And all of these scenes are really impactful and really interesting. And I think that's why I like this episode, because I really enjoy all these scenes. I think the characters are so well developed and the dialogue feels important and poetic in a way with while still feeling naturalistic. I just think it's written really well. I think this episode is really good.
I agree, actually. I think I'm going to take back my previous remarks. I've had to think about it now. And I think that this episode, I really didn't like Izzy. I think Izzy really rubbed me the wrong way this episode.
Interesting. Yeah.
She was being nasty and meddlesome.
Mm-hmm. She's being jealous.
Mm-hmm.
So Thatcher confronts George in the corridor and says, "Do you know where Meredith is? Are you friends with her?" George says, "Yes, I used to be her housemate. We know each other." And so Thatcher ends up talking to George, telling George the things he wanted to tell Meredith, which was that he doesn't know how to be there for her. He doesn't know her. Her mother would never let me know her, and now I don't know how to know her. And George stops playing games for a moment and says some really nice things about Meredith.
And Meredith's there to hear it.
Yeah.
All of it.
Which is important.
He says that she has the kind of smile that doesn't come out all the time, but when it does, it warms your entire soul.
Mm-hmm.
That she's kind and generous and goes out of her way for people. And it's all so lovely. He does say she's not perfect and that she definitely has her moments, as we all do. Mm. Which I think is fair.
And I think George makes a really important distinction that Meredith needs to hear and Thatcher needs to hear, and he does it very gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
Because Thatcher's said that Meredith's mother was cold, and George knows this. George has met Ellis. So by George saying Meredith is anything but cold, and she does smile, not that often because she's going through a lot, and that she is an incredible surgeon. She's the one to watch. She's the one to beat around here. And he says, "I think she gets that from her mother, but everything else is like the antithesis of her mother. So she must get it from you." And I think
that Meredith beams with pride.
He does. Yeah. And I think it's a really important moment. And I think Meredith really needs to hear that sometimes, because Meredith's worst fear is turning out like her mother. She thinks about it a lot. She kind of worries about it a lot. And for her friend to make that distinction, I think is really lovely. Especially when her friend's been a dick for ages and just been completely ignoring her.
Well, no, especially since she fucking broke her friend for him to say she is not an awful, horrible person like her mother.
That's yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, after that, Thatcher kind of goes away.
This is one of the best George moments of the last two seasons. The best George moments of all time so far.
I thought you'd like this George moment.
Yeah.
And Meredith tries to thank George and he just walks away.
Yeah, she kind of thanks him under her breath. So speaking of George, we do have a bit of a George storyline, because his relationship with Callie is progressing. We meet Callie a lot this episode. It's so great. We get a lot of Callie. We actually get this moment where...
Well, because Izzy's doing a lot of gossiping and a lot of bitching. A lot of this episode is fueled by Izzy. And Izzy's started off talking to Denny about everything that's going on and about this Callie doctor. Where did she come from? What's wrong with her? Why could she possibly see anything in George? What's she got to gain? And at lunch, she's bitching with the girls about Callie.
Mm-hmm.
And Callie, being the boss that she is, walks up to Izzy and Gray and says, "Right, I hear both of you don't like ortho. Grab this, follow me.
Let's go."
And Izzy is just picking at her.
Yeah, Izzy really doesn't let it go this episode. Her jealousy is really shining through. But
I'm so facetious.
I mean, it's not like I don't get it, because I don't think I would be like this, but I understand that Izzy is really hurt. She feels like she lost her best friend, because George was there around all the time. They were doing everything together. They were living together, and all of a sudden they're not. And he's not even really hanging out with them much, because Meredith's always around. So he's been hanging out with Callie, and I think she's just jealous and misses her friend.
But while George was going through all of this, Izzy was sleeping with Alex and spending the rest of her time with Denny. So who was being the shitty friend?
So true.
And now she is bitching about George behind his back and not welcoming in the new girl that's making him happy. Because if you want to spend more time with your friend, you should probably make sure his girlfriend doesn't hate you.
Mm. So Izzy's allowed to have two different boyfriends and George isn't allowed to have one. Yeah.
You know, she's, so what does your husband do? And Callie just sees right through all this shit.
Mm.
It's like, what are you trying to do here? You can be my friend. I'm a nice person.
And then Callie says the thing that finally makes them understand everything. She says, you don't see him, either of you. He's just George to you. He's just O'Malley, but he makes my world stop. He's sweet and kind and smart and strong, and he makes my world stop. So you shut up about him.
He's her McDreamy.
Mm-hmm. And then they finally kind of get it. Doesn't mean Izzy likes it, but she gets it for the first time.
How could you have so little, I don't know, respect maybe for your friend to think that no one could be sexually attracted to them?
I don't think it's that. I genuinely just think she's jealous and just misses George being around all the time. I just think it's that.
They just seem so shocked at the idea that someone could crave him.
Yeah. Yeah, she is. Oh, I want to defend her because I love Izzy, but I can't in this moment.
She might actually be the worst. We know she's a terrible housemate.
She's not the worst. She's being pretty bad now. She's not the worst.
Track record. Terrible housemate. Several occasions has been an awful, awful housemate. What she's recently done to Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Very unkind. Now bitching about her best mate to anyone who'll listen.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to sabotage his relationship. For what reason? And thinking that no one could be romantically inclined towards him?
Yeah, it's not good.
Kind of the worst. And also ignoring him when he is completely traumatized because, you know, you're falling in love and getting the dick. Like, mm-mm.
So at the end of this episode for George, he gets kicked out of his apartment because he saw Christina naked. And he decides to give Callie a call. He ends up wandering back to the hospital because he's a little bit lost. And as he's calling Callie, he's going there, I guess, to see if she's still at work, to see what she's doing. And the hospital is his first stop. As he's making this phone call, he realizes he can hear her phone ringing and he discovers Callie's secret hideaway. She discovers that she's been living in the hospital.
I like that she goes on to say when she's caught out, I'm not crazy. I'm not a crazy person. I'm just here all the time. So this made sense.
Hmm.
I don't know how none of them noticed when they spend so much time in that corridor on those gurneys.
She made a little wall.
She made a nest.
She made a little nest.
And
I just think it must be a part that they haven't really seen before. Look, it's confusing, but it's cute in a way.
Yeah.
And he ends up asking if she can give him a haircut.
And spend so much time in this episode talking about George's hair.
Mm-hmm, how it's grown.
It's bad. He looks like a member of Oasis.
And then as she's cutting her hair, he grabs her arm and pulls it around her. And they have a little kiss. And their romance has officially started. So the last patient we have to talk about, look, it's not a huge storyline. but it's Derek's patient. And Bailey is at the hospital and she's realized that she doesn't have any surgeries today. And she begs Derek to put her on her service because she said, yeah, the chief's angry at me because I went and had a baby, but I can still be a surgeon and I need to do some surgery. Otherwise, I'll basically lose all my skills, which is something that we've been talking about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets in on Derek's service and Derek is performing awake brain surgery on this
teenager,
lovely teenager.
And Derek tries to bond with him. He's like, so you like sports? No. You like girls? No. Do we know about Bailey's favorite genre of movies yet?
I don't think so. Okay, I don't think we know too much about Bailey yet.
That's what I thought she was going to talk to him about, and I got very excited. But no, turns out he likes spelling.
Yeah. So he is a spelling bee champion and he's got some more championships coming up. And Bailey gets it straight away. She gets in on his level. She ends up sitting with him and getting him to spell big words, and they're bonding. And it's just really nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really beautiful scene, and Derek tries to get in on the action and he's like, oh, I'll choose a word. And he chooses a word that's really big for me, but.
I have always been so envious of the spelling bee people, but I wonder how much of it they retain. Because I remember doing like little spelling bees at school, and then I got the booklet for the national spelling bee and was like, no.
I find it so impressive.
So impressive.
I love it when they say things like, what's the origin of the word? And you find out, and that helps them. Like, that's going to be a clue. And it's like, oh, so they know what different languages use different sound, like how different languages use different sounds. And
or how the letters are placed from the Roman alphabet. Like, oh, if it's, I don't know, a Grecian word, it might be A before E or something like that.
It is very, very impressive.
And they're always like under 14.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I would love to hear from someone who was a spelling champion in primary and middle school, or know someone who was, because I would really like to know, I've always thought about it, how many of those words do they actually remember? Like, are they a very good speller to this day? Because I was excellent at statistics and trigonometry in school, and I don't think I could do half of it now.
But you're not doing that sort of thing in your everyday life. I think spelling would be different because you'd learn all the rules of spelling and how like words are compounded and stuff. And then because you're, you know, in our day-to-day life, we do read and we do write. And I think seeing words all the time, I think you would keep it up. I think you would keep that knowledge. Whereas geometry and trigonometry and stuff, you don't.
I'd love to know though. I'd be so impressed.
I really want to watch a spelling bee championship because have you seen Grace and Frankie?
The first season, yes.
So I don't know what season it is, but I've forgotten their names now, but the two guys, they watch the spelling bee, no, Frankie and Sol watch the spelling bee championships together every year. And that's like one of the things, and it's on one day and, you know, they're calling each other up and they're both like watching it at the same time. And I was like, I actually would love to watch that. Also, there's a musical called the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, which is a really awesome musical.
Those songs must be very difficult.
It's a really, really cute. It's really good. And it's all adults playing young kids. I saw it when it was in Melbourne years ago. Magda Zabanski was in it and she was excellent.
I was just about to ask, to be honest. I know all the words to Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. All I can think of is learning all the colours in that and how difficult it was. So learning a song where you had to spell out all of these big words.
Mm.
How do you spell together in your head?
T-O-G-E-T-H-E-R.
Not to get her?
No.
About Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Okay, yeah, exactly the same. I've been working in the hospitality industry for, what, 18, 19 years this year? And it took me the longest time in the world to learn how to spell restaurant.
Oh, that I trip over that one all the time.
Mm-mm, I've got it now. I'm good at it. Yep. I was very proud of that a few years ago when I typed it out and didn't get the red line. I was like, it's finally happened.
A word that I cannot spell, and it annoyingly I have to write it a lot, is the word attached. And it's every time I'm sending an email and I'm like, oh, my resume or my headshot is attached. I get it wrong. And it shouldn't be that hard. So I've constantly have to come up with new ways to say it's like, I have put my headshot in this email. Link. You will also get my headshot in this email because I can't do it.
Above, my two that I can't spell for love or money, are two that I actually have to say reasonably often, mm-hmm. And that's nauseous or diarrhea.
Oh. Why do you have to say them so much?
Because I have IBS.
Oh. Yeah, but you're not typing that out. Who are you typing that to?
Anyone who asks how I'm doing.
Oh, okay.
Because okay. I'm either nauseous, okay. constipated, or have diarrhea. It's one way or the other. Oh, I love a voice message.
That's so funny.
Mm. This is why we have a podcast and not a blog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What were we talking about? Spelling bees.
Yes. So this beautiful boy, yeah, they hit the part of his brain that's the language part, and he can't really talk anymore. And then they fix him.
They fix him. That's it.
That's kind of it. It's just a really beautiful Bailey moment. I think she does some really beautiful acting in this scene.
And she gets a little bit teary.
Mm.
And Derek goes to be like, nah, you're having a little cry. And she's like, I'm still a damn surgeon. I'm just a surgeon with an excess of estrogen. Can you spell that? Estrogen? And of course he can.
Yeah.
And then Derek asks him to spell denial. Shut up, Derek. Normally we'll leave our wrap-ups to the end, but all of our stories were quite...
Our wrap-ups have been too important, I think.
For the story.
To not say them as we go, but there is one final wrap.
Yep. And it's Meredith sitting in what appears to be a wood cabin, aggressively knitting.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera pans to a receptionist. So she's waiting for something. She's waiting for a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Derek offhandedly mentions that there's something wrong with the dog. Him and Addison have a bit of doctor banter. And he's dropped him off at the vet. So Meredith is going to go and...
They have weird banter about Doc being sick when they're at the hospital. Like, it's weird that they do it at the hospital and not at home.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But the receptionist I love, and I really hope we do get to see more of her, because she says to Meredith, oh... So you've just started knitting? And she's like, yeah, I'm doing pretty well. She's like, vow of celibacy then?
Mm-hmm. It's funny that, yeah, it's really funny. She clicks straight away.
Picks it up. And I don't know how long this vow is going to last. Is she going to knit an entire sweater?
Not in the slightest. Because as I said at the start of this episode, as soon as you decide that you're quitting dating, going off of getting a vow of celibacy. Celibacy? Who am I?
Someone taking who likes celery a vow too much?
Of celery.
Only if it's covered in peanut butter.
As soon as you do that, well, you meet McVet. So
and
she's
oops,
sitting.
She did it again.
Oh, yes.
And he says, oh, hi, you must be Doc's other owner. I'm Finn, your very hot vet.
And she doesn't say a fucking word. No, it's just this comic moment. Her mouth, her jaw is open. She's staring at this guy, and all of a sudden she just dives straight back into her knitting. And she's like, don't look up, just keep knitting. Don't look up, just keep knitting.
Do you think that he's going to say, oof, give me more of her? Or is he not the womanizer kind?
That was good. That was good to end on. I'm happy with that.
That was two for the price of one.
It really was. Get your money's worth with Ayla.
You're welcome. Britney Spears is the theme of this episode. Congratulations, Britney, by the way.
Yeah. So I think it is a really important episode. That is where we leave it.
I thought you were going to make the doggy style joke that I was going to make.
No.
I'll save that make for another it. Episode.
Oh, you can't end like that.
From the back, yes, I can. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening.
We hope you all enjoyed this episode.
Hit us up on at Scalpels and Tequila on Instagram. And if you want to see what we do in our private lives, I am at Misty Hayes. Ayla is at Ayla _ Azure. And we will be back in your ears next week. Bye.
Vagina.
Sing it.
Vagina.